Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory number 77. Eric Name is with us today from The Athletic to talk about the Bucks, a team that's intrigued me for a while. We did a Giannis episode last year around this time with Miren Fader. She wrote the biography of Giannis up to this point, right through the championship. I believe the soft cover is out for that now, by the way, with an epilogue on the championship run that the Bucks made last year. So go check that out again. I might tweet that on the Dome Theory account as I record this, so you'll be able to find that if you go back over to Dome Theory on Twitter. Of course, brought to you by betonline.ag. It's a great time, and we're going to get into all the different sports happenings around Boston and the NBA playoffs today before we talk to Eric. But you have Kentucky Derby this weekend on Sunday. Saturday. You have baseball rolling. You have hockey playoffs. Bruins in a bad spot. As I'm recording this, they haven't played Game 3 yet, but I'm assuming it's not going to go well the way this series has tracked so far. But enjoy the Bruins hockey as well as the entire NHL playoffs while they're here, as well as the NBA playoffs. It's nonstop action over at betonline.ag, the number one source for all your betting needs and sports info. If you're just looking for odds and stuff, go over to betonline.ag. Their site's so great. They got all the horse matchups up right now for the Kentucky Derby. Epicenter, Zandon, Messier, Taba, Charge It, Crown Pride, Smile Happy, Simplification. They're all there. All the odds are listed. Go check that out. It's a place to be if you want to bet a horse on the Kentucky Derby. That always makes it a little more fun to watch. As well as the NBA playoffs. Series odds still out there. Celtics now favorites over the Bucks after their Game 2 win, minus 135. NBA futures championship favorites. The Suns back in pole position as they take control of the series against the Mavericks. Celtics now third, tied for third with the Miami Heat since they've tied their series. That says a lot, especially with the control that the Heat have of their series. Bucks long shot, plus 700. If you feel good about them in this series, it's a great number to get them at right now. Finals matchups, those props are also out as well. Celtics-Suns, plus 375, the second most likely matchup behind Heat-Suns. I don't like the sound of that, by the way. No Celtics or Bucks in the finals. I do like the Heat, but not that much. Heat-Warriors, eh. Celtics-Warriors. Now, talk about a matchup you want to see. After those years where they almost met in the finals, still would be a great matchup to this day. It's all available, betonline.ag. Sports developments, updated odds, MLB fights, even next season's NFL futures, they're all there right now. It's the best time ever to go to betonline.ag and get started. Of course, massive bonus to get started, 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use the code CLNS50, please. Support us at Dome Theory, The Garden Report, as well as CLNS Media as a whole. Use the code CLNS50. Put $100 in, you'll get $50 back free to bet. Super easy to get started. Like I said, the site is just awesome. Live betting, favorite Vegas casino and poker games, it's all there. BetOnline.ag, where the game starts. HelloFresh, we've been telling you about them on The Garden Report. HelloFresh.com/playoff16. 16 free meals. We've been kicking around the meatloaf, spaghetti with chicken, the tacos, which were just exceptional. I think I'm actually going to get back on and order some more of those tacos because that came away by and far my favorite out of all those meals. You try stuff and you get 16 free meals. You'll try a lot for free when you sign up for HelloFresh. Deliver the meat fresh in a cooling package underneath all the ingredients laid out. Many of them cut, spices included, instructions laid out there. It makes it so easy for you to get dinner rolling. In fact, as I get ready for Milwaukee right now as I record this to head out tomorrow morning, don't have a ton of time to prep. I'm going to use HelloFresh. All the ingredients laid out. And again, we've really enjoyed this. We posted some of the stuff we've done. I think we might do a video at one point of some of the meals we've made with HelloFresh. It would help us a lot if you went and get started with them. And again, they're making it worth your while here. HelloFresh.com/playoff16. HelloFresh.com/playoff16. 16 free meals, 3 free gifts to get started at HelloFresh. And of course, you support us here at CLNS. Overall thoughts through 2 games. Giannis, intimidating. They've slowed him, but I'm still waiting for him to break through. scares me. And now they're talking about a Chris Middleton return. Doors open for it later in this series, maybe. You're going to want to jump on the Bucks right away when you get out to Milwaukee. You don't want to go down 3-1, obviously. Even 2-2 is trouble, I think, as Giannis puts more wear and tear on the Boston defenders and they find ways to manipulate the Celtics defense. Right now, I think the Celtics have them in a good position where they're pinching that lane. They're making Giannis guess. They're causing them to hesitate, much like Kevin Durant did. And the way the Celtics took advantage against that, when they played the Nets, they went right to Brooklyn and put them away. It's going to be a more intimidating environment there in Milwaukee, where role players like Bobby Portis, Pat Connaughton, Grace Allen, all those guys are prone to go off. And do you get the same performances from Grant Williams, Peyton Pritchard in that spot? It's going to come down to Jason Tatum breaking loose there, I think, and finally taking control of the offensive game, meshing scoring with passing, and solving some of the Celtics' half-court issues that they've have ran into in Game 1. Game 2, brilliant passing effort, some of the best we've seen from the Celtics all year, but they got a little stagnant again in that second half, and the way the Bucks defend, it's prone to making you do that. Suns-Mavericks, again, I feel like we've overlooked the possibility that Suns-Bucks could become that annual matchup for a couple years here. That fell out of favor with the Bucks running into Boston in round two and the Suns having some trouble round one with the Pelicans, Devin Booker getting hurt, Warriors looking exciting. People forgot about how that felt like the inevitable finals rematch for a little while, and I think we're gaining some momentum toward that happening again. Suns look like they're going to blow through the Mavericks. Not Luka's strongest performance, but he did get through it around two. Still think some patience is worthwhile there. I heard an idea of Rudy Gobert of Mavericks, by the way. Really good idea. I think that makes a lot of sense, along with the Warriors and some other teams that could court Gobert this summer. Suns, favorites out west still by far. I mean, Chris Paul, ridiculous what he's doing at 36. He is the model, I think, for James Harden to get back on his feet, and that's a good transition to Philly. Can't believe Embiid's playing tonight. Finger, concussion worries, orbital fracture, pain, mask. He's going to go through it all and play out there. Obviously played through a torn meniscus last postseason. He's one of the most ruthless competitors we've ever seen from a playing through injury standpoint. If he goes out there and wins a game for them, that'll be Philly lore type stuff. Because then they're going to need it right now because Harden does not look good. I think everyone on every platform, radio, TV, newspaper, digital, has talked about Harden's decline. But the more I go back and forth on it, you're just going to have to keep him. Hopefully they can negotiate the contract a little lower than something that's going to make them pay $60 million in 2026. But they have no choice. His passing, I think, is enough right now that when this full team comes together and maybe they make some additions along the edges, still better than any replacement option they could get. I don't think there'd be a strong trade market for him. And on his end, where else are you going to go if you're him? You've burned through two teams at this point. I know you don't want to give up money if you're him, but if it helps make the team a little stronger going into next year and you get a full camp of Harden and Embiid, I'm still going to wait it out. Same feeling I have on Ben Simmons, who strangely had back surgery last week. That's concerning. The Nets were ready to throw him out there for a game four, but it was, from his standpoint, a situation where he needed surgery. Don't like the sound of that at all. And we obviously talked last week on Dome Theory 76 about the worrisome path that the Nets have taken here. 3 years of going in the wrong direction, really. So you'd still rather be Philly than Brooklyn, I think. But not because of that trade, for other reasons. And Embiid's the chief among them. Heat, I mean, load management in the playoffs. They win that series against the Hawks, sitting Butler, Lowry. Others are on injury report right now. I'm interested to see who actually plays tonight. Can they win against the 76ers resting guys? Lowry hasn't been a big factor to their postseason run yet. It's amazing the depth they have, the interchangeability. They're a real threat to make the finals. I don't want to see it because I don't find their brand of basketball too exciting compared to the Bucks and Celtics, but I have a lot of respect for that squad down there in South Beach, and I think a Celtics-Heat rematch East Finals would be very poetic. Feels like the Heat are just going to blow through this, but we got to see them in Philly. That's a tough place to win. Golden State-Memphis. Only thought on that, everyone's going to come out of there with eyes swollen, arms facing the wrong way, like the Dave Chappelle attacker. That's the kind of visuals I get, and of course, I'm at the Celtics games when those are starting. I don't catch much of them, but I do catch the post-game pressers and the TNT wrap after. And I just see everybody bleeding, injured. Dylan Brooks, Gary Payton, that was a grisly scene. One game suspension, not a big deal to me. Guy gets hurt. Malicious act, flagrant two. I think it's warranted a game. That's what the Grayson Allen situation ended in. Feels a little soft compared to a guy who is about to miss weeks and weeks here at the very least, but what are you going to suspend Brooks as long as Payton's out? That's just not how it works. So I think the suspension was appropriate there. Could have been two games. I feel like that goes a little bit over the line in a playoff series. So it's not fair, but I think it's all they have the ability to do, just like you only get 25K for throwing your middle fingers up in the air. I thought Irving deserved a little bit more than that in that Celtics series. Green probably deserved a little more for two, but that's what they hash out here when it comes to the collective bargaining. That's enough of me grandstanding here. Eric Names with us. We have a good conversation coming up about the Bucks, who I find so intriguing for a million different reasons, who I'm super respectful and terrified of. And as this series stands, I'm holding out on Celtics in seven, but man, am I on the cliff of jumping off that and shifting and taking the Bucks here, because they are load to handle. And I don't know how long you can hold down Giannis in single coverage. It's amazing that the Celtics have been able to do it. But that's the biggest thing I'm watching in Milwaukee. We'll see what Eric thinks about a lot of the topics being kicked around on the Bucks and Celtics right now. Right after this, Dome Theory 77. Check us out. iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. We're on all those spots. And the YouTube stream rolling live. I think Friday's our sweet spot right now, playoff time for recording. So keep an eye on Dome Theory for updates at Dome Theory. Here is Eric Name. Hey, Buddy Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory 77. Man, do we have a series to talk about, and we're going to talk about it with Eric Name of The Athletic from Milwaukee. Beautiful Milwaukee this time of year. We'll be heading out there tomorrow. Caught a couple Bucks practices before we got going here, but this series, Eric, it's starting to remind me of Bucks Nets a year ago, and I think that holds the crown as one of the best series ever, at least that I've watched in my lifetime. Probably one of the more consequential series in NBA history, considering where it sent the Bucks and where it sent the Nets at this point. But this one feels similar to me at this point. You got this championship repeat contender in the Bucks. You have this rising team in the Celtics that are trying to gain that status in the East, surprise some people, come out of the East, which I still think would surprise a lot of people. And I don't know, I have the sense that this series, the winner of this series, could be the team that goes on to win the NBA championship.
Yeah, I think coming into this series, it definitely felt like the Eastern Conference Finals to me, that this was going to be the two teams that, you know, anyone was going to be picking once they got to the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, that's what everyone's going to do with the winner here. And I think this is pretty much I'm not going to say it's played out exactly how we all thought it was. I probably would have reversed these two outcomes because the Bucks tend to lose game ones. That's just kind of their thing under Mike Budenholzer. So I figured, you know, they were going to lose game one and then the Bucks would have came back and won game two, but we flipped them. But either way, you know, we go back to Milwaukee. They'll be here tomorrow in five-serve form, and I think we're about to be in for a really tough series. I think these two teams match up really well, and I think it only gets more interesting from here.
Yeah, it's a contrast of styles for sure, an interesting one. Celtics have spread the ball out really well, gotten everyone going. Grant Williams, ginormous in game two. Pritchard having moments, Horford hitting big shots, and really the ball has been taken away from Jason Tatum, much like in the first round, in ways that have made his teammates try to beat the Bucks. On the Bucks side, it feels like it's all about Giannis and what he's going to be able to do one-on-one against the Celtics defense. And I know you were asking about that in a lot of the press conferences, Boston's ability to make him play one-on-one. And it's just startling what Al Horford at 35 and Grant Williams in isolation have been able to do against them. Game one, he's held down, but he kills the Celtics with his passing, which was just an astounding performance on that side of his game. But game two, they stay home on the shooters. They hold the Bucks to 16% from three, and they hold Giannis down in isolation, which, I mean, you've watched every game of Giannis's last couple of years here. Have you ever really seen a defense hold him down like they did in game two?
I mean, the standards that have kind of always been set for Giannis, or at least the way that Giannis describes it, is the Raptors in the 2018-19 series, where the Bucks dropped four in a row in the Eastern Conference Finals after taking a 2-0 lead, and then the Heat in the bubble. You know, if you listen to Giannis talk about, you know, the teams that really hold him down or, you know, have defended him well in the past, it is those two teams. Those are the ones that he kind of thinks of. That's kind of his like gold standard for how all of this works and how defending him works. And the performance in game two looked very similar to a number of those nights. It looked like he got sped up offensively. It looked like, you know, he encountered a tough on-ball defender, and then on the backside, there was someone else to clean it up. There was also wings reaching in and stuff like that. And I'm honestly just really curious to see what he does the rest of this series, because, you know, there have been series where he's struggled early on and then figured some things out and figured out how to be successful. So I'm fascinated to see if the Bucks can actually manage to do that and find ways to get him loose, because I do think it's quite a bit harder without Chris Middleton. You know, with Chris Middleton, on a night that Giannis isn't going, one, Chris Middleton can score. But then two, Chris Middleton in the pick and roll can find Giannis. They've been working together now for 8 years. They know each other's games inside out. They know how to, you know, work off of each other. And without Middleton, you know, the Celtics are going to essentially tell Grayson Allen and Pat Connaughton and Wesley Matthews, beat them. Like, go for it. If you guys want to, go take all those layups. Go take dunks. Do whatever you want. Because, you know, we don't care. Like, we're just not going to let Giannis touch the ball. And I think that's where all this gets really interesting is, you know, if he can figure out ways to do this in isolation. You know, if you watch the Nets series that you referenced last year, you know, the biggest shot Giannis hits is a hook shot over Kevin Durant. Okay. Can he get to his spots and actually rise up for that? You know, he obviously likes the fadeaway on the baseline. Can he get to that shot? It's a shot that they've taken away thus far. But can he find ways to do this one-on-one? It's something that he hasn't been able to do thus far this series. We've seen him struggle before in these situations, but also we've seen the Bucks, you know, as he is struggling, find ways to open him up. So we'll see kind of what happens as the series progresses.
Yeah, it feels like, and everything's on a string the way these two teams are playing, because Boston's offense was horrendous in game one, and that opened up the opportunities for him to get on the open floor. Obviously, the Bucks are maybe the best transition team in the NBA, and their execution on offense kind of took that away in game two. Just the passing, especially in that second quarter, was picturesque. I mean, that's what I love most about basketball, is when a team gets passing at that level, and that's effectively, along with 47% 3-point shooting, what did the Bucks in game two there. I'm just waiting in the half court, and I think Giannis has grown in the half court for him to beat that one-on-one defense that's in front of them. And I'm shocked. I think it started to open up a little bit in that third quarter, but just how well one-on-one defense has held against him. Like, you don't even think that's possible, that whether it's Horford or Grant or whoever else is out there. I think the other Celtics have struggled outside of those two, but for one-on-one defense to hold him down like it has, that's got to just kind of go back to him, I think. Like, at some point, he's going to find, I don't know, the will, the spots, the positions on the floor to beat that, or even the jump shots like you talked about. I don't know about the fadeaway for him. I know it's in his arsenal, but I think the Celtics are okay with him shooting that. Maybe it's a mid-range pull-up that gets him going. He said he had a handful of those in game one, and he certainly got to the free throw line a bunch in that second half. That's another area he can do it from. But in terms of trying to just charge into the lane, these Celtics defenders, they're so strong. Like, there was one play where he smashed into Grant at full speed, and Grant didn't even move. I was like, oh man, this is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, those two have been really tough thus far. You know, it's to me interesting to see how Giannis has tried to attack thus far. I think a lot of it was, you know, game one, he's going to sit there, he's going to survey the floor, sees early help from the Celtics, and makes the right pass. Game two, they decided not to do that. And as soon as he saw that, it was okay. Well, I've gotten the ball in my hands. I've surveyed the floor. The pass isn't there, so now I should attack. And I just thought over and over again, we saw him, you know, essentially first dribbles with his right hand. He's going to try to go very hard. He's going to try to go as quickly as he could with that right hand. And I just honestly thought he got predictable that once they saw him survey the floor, they were able to, you know, puff their chest out and say, all right, like, you're going to try to go to your right and you're going to try to make a quick move that direction. All right. We know what's coming. Like, we can handle this bump. And I'm really interested to see if in game three, we see more variety from him. If we see quick moves to his left or right, if we see him, you know, actually go left, if we see him spin baseline, you know, if we see the Bucks put him in different spots than what we saw in game one and game two. Cause, you know, I thought in game one, the Bucks opened and put him in the same spots that they put him in game one. The Celtics didn't help in the same way that they did in game one. And then they had Giannis and then Drew Holiday as well try to beat the Celtics in isolation. In the second half, I thought we saw the Bucks say, okay, well, if this is how you're going to play and you're not going to help, then we're going to screen with Grayson Allen every time down the floor. And you're going to switch on one of your wings and Giannis is going to get whatever he wants against that person. And that's exactly what happened. And obviously we saw a whole second half of that, which means Ime Udoka saw the exact same things, which means game three, you're probably not going to see the same coverages that you saw in game two. And I think that's going to be kind of the cat and mouse game that these two teams play for the rest of the series is, okay, game one, Bucks came out, did their thing. Game two, the Celtics came out, knew what the Bucks were going to do, made the adjustments. And then now it's, you know, if this is how the series is going to go, the ball should be back in the Bucks court that, all right, how are you going to adjust to their adjustments and how are you going to get yourself open and how are you going to create offense and kind of do all those things. So this feels very much like kind of like the back and forth that you're going to have in any series. But I think ultimately you have to see what Giannis can do in those one-on-one spots. You know, I remember, I guess, let's see, it had been 18-19 season, so 3 years ago. You know, Giannis at the end of that season, we had a long conversation at The Athletic kind of about, you know, the playoff journey and different things. And, you know, like the quote that he said was like, you know, by the end of that Celtics series, my back was hurting. But I knew that if my back was hurting, Al Horford's back was damn sure hurting. And it was probably hurting even worse. And we've seen this kind of in the past is that, you know, for the first couple of games of a series, hey, I'll put my chest on Giannis. Yep, I can do this. And then all of a sudden it gets to game five and game six.
If you're an older guy.
And you're a little bit older. And even if you're a younger guy like Grant Williams, like there's a difference between doing that to Giannis once or twice. And then there's a difference between doing it to him a lot. And for game three, I think they're going to be fine, right? They just had 3 days off in between this. So I think really where we're going to start to see, and I do think this is going to end up being a long series, is like, okay, what is game six, game seven? What do those look like, you know, as you try to figure all those things out?
Yeah, and you mentioned the Middleton factor. I think a lot of Celtics fans made a big deal about that on that side. And I said coming into the series, like just the Giannis factor alone, I know Middleton's a big loss for them, but that guy, just the motor's not going to stop with him until it hits 0-0 in that final elimination game. And he's going to keep going downhill. He's going to keep attacking the basket. As you said, he's going to keep laying into Horford and Grant or whoever else is in him until the series is over, and it very well could be seven games here. So there is a physicality holdup factor that is enormous. We already saw Marcus Smart get damaged in game one pretty badly. Who knows how he's going to look for the rest of this year. But on that Middleton point, what do they lose most in him? I think the clutch sets are what people make a big deal out of, but I feel like Holiday and Giannis's numbers, at least in crunch time, have been fairly even with Middleton's this year. And I think they've adapted past the point where they need Middleton to take all the shots in those situations. But he's also another perimeter defender on this defense. And I find the Bucks defense so interesting. Obviously they drop, obviously they give up the threes. But they're also contesting so hard. In game two, it felt like any up fake was going to send them into the rafters. They had stretches this season where they were like bottom 10, bottom 5, bottom 10 in defense. And again, in game one, they were awesome. Game two, they were pretty erratic, giving up 65 in that first half. So they've been all over the place defensively. I feel like that might be the underrated spot where they might miss Middleton most, as much as he gives them on offense.
Man, it's tough. So on defense, it hurts a lot without Chris because the Bucks in crunch time for, I mean, pretty much as long as Bud has been around is, you know, the crunch time fourth quarters, they'll start using a small ball lineup. They'll start to switch. And Chris Middleton is 6'7" and he can handle guards. He can handle wings. If necessary, he can hold up against a big for a little while. Like he can do all those things. Now, if the Bucks want to go small, they can't do it, right? Because you're going to have either you try to do the three bigs with Bobby Portis and you have someone out there that's not quick enough. You try to go small, it's Grayson Allen, it's Pat Connaughton. They're not big enough to cover, you know, Jason Tatum or whoever it may be. And that hurts. I think just overall, it makes their matchups a lot tougher. It makes it a lot more likely that there's someone out there that isn't going to be able to compete defensively. But to me, offensively, 17 players in the league this year had 20 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists per game. Chris Middleton was one of them. 20 points, five
All-star.
rebounds, 5 assists. Like he was an all-star this year. Like this isn't just like, oh yeah, you know, when the Bucks are in trouble, they give it to Chris Middleton and he scores 15 points. Like, no, he's a legit like producer of shots. And I think the one stat that I've been quoting literally since the moment Chris Middleton went out is 44% of Chris Middleton's makes this year were assisted. So that means over half of his shots he created for himself without an assist, without a dribble handoff, without anything like that. Like that is
The counter
literally
to Giannis, because Giannis can do it a little bit, but not much.
correct. So you give Chris the ball and he can make something happen. And obviously you add the assist in there. And like I said, in the pick and roll game, in the dribble handoff game, you hand the ball off to Chris. Teams actually have to cover him. They're not just going to let Giannis hand it off or let Giannis set a screen for him and let him shoot wide open shots. That's not what they'll allow him to do because he's too good for that. He can go off. He can score 40. He did it twice in the Eastern Conference Finals and in the finals. Like he can do that. You can't let him go off. So you have to pay attention to him. And then when you have to pay attention to him, that's lobs for Giannis. That's easy pocket passes for Giannis. It's just easy buckets for him. To me, defensively, the Bucks have found a way thus far. Obviously, game two notwithstanding, that wasn't their best defensive performance, 65 points in the first half, but they found a way defensively without Middleton. Offensively, they've stunk. They have the worst offense in the playoffs right now, and it isn't really close. I think I put it in my story after game two. Of the 20 teams to participate in the play-in or playoffs, so the 20 teams that have participated in the postseason, the Bucks have the second worst offense, and the only team worse than them is the team that they beat in the first round, the Bulls. They just are struggling to score in the half court, and you know, as much as Giannis can make plays and create and you know attract double teams and do all these things, in that game one they only scratched off they can only scratch a. across enough points to barely win that game. It wasn't a dominant win, despite them having a great defensive night. And now you go to game two, and the Celtics scored 109. They probably scored closer to 115 or 120 if everyone plays the whole time and you actually have to play that thing out. But the Bucks scored 86 points. 86 points is just not going to be enough. So going into the series, I thought the defense might be a real struggle without Middleton. The Bucks have found a way to survive. Offensively is really where they're hurting right now without Chris.
Yeah, that's where it's going to have to come around. And Jrue Holiday, I find his role in it interesting. We'll get to his defense in a minute and the great piece you wrote earlier this year about him. By the way, Eric Name, go check out his work at The Athletic. He's the best covering the Bucks out there. But offensively for Holiday, you talk about like the pick and roll possibilities with Middleton and Giannis. Jrue, it's weird because he can get wherever he wants on the floor, it looks like, for himself and get a shot off. The creation that they need, a lot of it's come from Giannis so far. You don't see a lot of it from Jrue so far in this series, in my mind. And that might be where he needs to step up a little bit. Obviously, he's given them an enormous amount of production defensively, guarding Tatum, especially in game one to a degree. I wasn't sure it was possible, but went back and looked at the numbers and I was like, oh geez, like he can guard Tatum. And he's getting his shot off in spots, giving them the baskets to keep pace when they're down, pacing their lead when they're ahead, and hitting big threes in that game one that gave them that double digit lead. But the creation, I feel like, is the one thing that would turn the Bucks' offense around. It feels like, as you talked about with what they're missing in Middleton, someone needs to fill that gap in terms of creating off the dribble or creating for others.
I think the tough part is teams just don't care enough. They don't care if you put Jrue Holiday in a pick and roll. They're going to say, okay, shoot, that's fine. And especially in this series where I think it's been made clear that the Bucks could really use a way to get Giannis easy shots. And obviously the Celtics took care of transition in game two by making all of their shots. Simple way to get rid of transition points. Just make all of your shots in case you're curious. So they did that in game two. And if Giannis doesn't get out in transition in the half court, the only way he's going to get easy shots is if you pay attention to someone else in the pick and roll or the dribble handoff or whatever it may be. And I'm just not convinced in any way that the Celtics are going to do that. Like, why would they go out of their way to, you know, deny Grayson Allen the rim or, you know, do anything other than run him off the three-point line? And same thing with Pat Connaughton or whoever it may be. Like, what? Okay, Grayson Allen and Pat Connaughton, you guys want to get to the rim? Jrue Holiday, you want to shoot all of the pickup, you know, pull-up threes? Okay, that's fine. Totally fine, because Giannis isn't getting easy ones. And I think that's kind of the problem that the Bucks are in, is they got to find ways to make the Celtics care about their other people and actually pay attention. And Holiday, for as good as he's been this year, and he really has been fantastic in different parts of the season, I think that's a spot where if you give the Celtics or any other team the option between Jrue Holiday and Giannis Antetokounmpo, they're going to pick Jrue Holiday 10 times out of 10 and say, Jrue, go score 40. We don't care. We're not sure you can do it. But if you can, great, because Giannis still hasn't gotten going. And I think that's going to be the tough part.
Yeah, they got to get on transition. That's the story of the series. I think if they're able to do it, they'll probably win it. The Celtics execute offensively and keep them out of transition. That's probably going to be what swings in their factor. They also got the home court in game 7 for whatever that's worth. I do kind of want to get in your experience covering the Bucks for our last half here. Of course, they're coming off a championship here, and I'm sure you have a million stories from a championship run coming out of that. But I want to get a feel for just how they've changed Milwaukee. I went there a couple weeks ago. There's obviously huge development around the stadium, new stadium, fan base is energized. You see the thousands and thousands of people standing outside during the finals there. I just want to get a feel of how this team and their success over the last 2-3 years here have changed the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably starts with 2015. You have new ownership come in. Herb Cole, who will obviously, it's called Herb Cole Way, the street right by Fiserv Forum, and it's called that for a reason, because in the 80s the Bucks were going to move. They weren't 100% sure if they're going to be able to find a new owner or a new arena, and he built the Bradley Center at that point. So essentially Herb Cole kept the team in town, and then it was the 2010s. They were starting to figure out, does he want to keep the team anymore? He was getting a little bit older in age. And essentially, you know, there was a time where he was going to sell the team to Michael Jordan at the same time when Jordan ended up buying the Bobcats, which ends up being the Hornets. Around that same time, the Bucks were going to sell to Jordan, but Jordan wouldn't commit to keeping the team in Milwaukee. And Herb Cole said, nope, I got to find someone that's willing to do it. You know, Mark Lazary and Wes Edens stepped in and bought the Bucks in 2015, committed to keeping them. They went out and, you know, built an arena. And now that arena is, as you mentioned, having tens of thousands of people outside of it, it's been too cold for that, to be totally honest here, in the first and second round. But last year in the finals, it was insanity. Like, just how many people were all the way around, you know, the arena, and just kind of, it's been really quite a scene to see the city embrace the team like they have, embrace basketball like they have, embrace the NBA like they have. And obviously a huge part of it is Giannis kind of coming of age at the same time as the arena was getting built, new ownership was coming in. Like, the fact that the Bucks were able to marry those two things together, Giannis in a new arena, and then on top of that, Mike Boonholzer in that same time frame, like Bud has never coached a game in a different arena than Fiserv Forum. Like the Bud era starts at the exact same time as the new arena's era. And oh, by the way, that's just as Giannis was having his first MVP season. Like all Milwaukee has known since the new arena has been around has been winning basketball. And Bud is off to an insane pace as a coach. The winningest coach the Bucks have ever seen. And they've had some good ones over the years. And it's just kind of crazy to think that, you know, all of this has gone right in so quickly and for so many years now. Like this is year four of the Bucks being very, very, very good. And it's kind of a new scene, especially, you know, in the 31 years that I've been alive. Like the only season before that was good was the 2000-2001 season when they went to the Eastern Conference Finals with the big three of Ray Allen, Glenn Robinson, and Sam Cassell. Like they just haven't been good. And now it's just unparalleled success for four seasons in a row.
Yeah, and they have a real personality, a real energy that you would think a championship team would have between Bobby Portis and Brooke Lopez coming in and solidifying things. Like they just have a great cast of characters, not only from an on-court standpoint, the way the team meshes and just the style they have is very distinct, especially how it fits around Giannis, but off the court too. And Giannis, I feel like he's got to be like one of the 2 to 5 most intriguing characters in NBA history. Just when you think of the background, the story, how he got where he was coming in the league, where he did. The book Maren Fader wrote last year, like just recounting all of that was just amazing because it happened so quietly. And it felt like just out of nowhere one day he was that MVP menace, taking over the league, becoming the face of the league in a lot of different ways. So you've been around him. I know you got to talk to him after the parade last year, the championship. You were around that whole run there and just him cementing his place in NBA history through last spring. That run intrigued me in a way I don't think any other run has outside of Boston. Like I was just captivated by every step of the way. Him going down the East Finals, coming back from what looked like an injury that could have like knocked him out for a year. It was like, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. And then he's back having one of the most iconic finals performances ever and one of the most iconic plays in the finals ever with the block there. I mean, there's just a million different things you can say about him. Where does your mind go just in terms of covering him these last couple of years? If you had to tell a Giannis story or just kind of encapsulate what he's become.
I mean, there's, like you said, a million of them, but you know, him going down and being hurt in that game, in Atlanta, you just kind of, like you said, thought, okay, not only is there goes the Bucks season, there goes next season.
Yeah.
Like with the way that his knee bent back there, it just seemed impossible that he'd be anything other than out for the rest of the season and probably all of the next season. And, you know, it's just this thing where this dude in many ways feels superhuman. You know, in the past, I've kind of joked with people. One of my favorite stories about him is there was a game, I guess that would have been in 16, 17, 17, 18, somewhere in there. Where both him and Matthew Dellavedova sprained their ankles in the same game. And I'm telling you, injuries were identical. The way it happened, they both stepped on a foot, same foot, all of it looked the exact same. And Giannis went back into that game and played, and Deli was out for 3 weeks. And it was just like, wait, they both did the same thing. How is one dude back in the game and the other dude is out for 3 weeks? And it just gets to this point where it's like, what is this dude made of? Like, how is it possible that he just seemingly can't get hurt, that nothing can affect him, that he can get through? And there's just this belief with him where he's always going to find a way. And that to me just kind of felt like all of it. Like
there was a game, I think it was against the Heat earlier this season, that just encapsulated the way he plays. I'm trying to remember all the details off the top of my head, but I think the Heat were like in full control. There was an inbounds or something, and he just dove to the floor, got the jump ball. They got a game winner off of it. And, like, the them getting back possession to have a chance to win was so improbable, but he just kept playing, and he got the jump ball, and they won the game. I think Middleton hit a shot or something. Yeah. And that just encapsulated who he is. Like, he's just never going to stop. The motor does not shut off until the series is over, the game's over, possession's over. It's just nonstop.
And honestly, I think that's a huge part of the Bucks culture as well, is that they've just integrated everything that he's done in just kind of who he is. Like, the fact that he doesn't give up means everybody else, like, if that is your tone setter, okay, I can't miss a workout. I can't half-ass a workout. I can't not hustle for a play. I can't miss this box, whatever it is. I can't do it. Because that guy that's won two MVPs, that's won a finals MVP, that's done all of these things, is still going harder than me. Like, that's the standard. And I think everything has just kind of become easy from that point, in that, you know, Mike Budenholzer's always said that this is a guy that's very coachable, that, you know, if I need to get after Giannis for not trying hard enough or whatever it may be, like, I can do that. I can let him know that he's doing that. And again, these are kind of like the stories you used to hear about Tim Duncan, right? Where Greg Popovich would just lay into Tim Duncan, and Tim Duncan took it because he was like, this is what the team needs to see. Like, you need to be able to coach the team. And that means you got to be able to coach me because I'm the standard setter. And honestly, I guess that parallel ends up becoming so easy to draw, just because Giannis is much more exciting than Tim Duncan, both as a person and just as a player. But that's what, the fact that you have a guy from the Pop Tree and Bud, and then you have Giannis, it just feels like that Tim Duncan, Greg Popovich connection, where this dude sets the standard, this dude tries hard every single night, this dude works hard. All of that just feels like this is how you build a great franchise, and that's exactly what the Bucks have done since Mike Budenholzer has been here.
Yeah, and you think of the improvement too, the will to improve and carve out these other areas that you, most guys would just look at his weaknesses in their games and things that the free throws, first and foremost. It's unreal what he's done at the free throw line after looking like he just couldn't make them, period, a year ago in that Brooklyn series, the countdown. And it was like, oh, geez, this is going to be like the next big Giannis failure in the playoffs. They lost that series to Toronto, the bubble meltdown, and now it's going to be Giannis getting clowned at the free throw line and missing all of them in Brooklyn. But even just within that game seven, he turned it around toward the end of the game. Then the end of the NBA Finals, he has that game where he hit almost all of them to close it out, the 50-pointer. And now this year, I think it's up to 72% in the regular season. This series, it's down a little bit again, but you don't feel bad when he's at the free throw line anymore. He's got that release down. Nobody can really even count anymore. And he just shut all that down within the course of the year there. And I know you were really into the passing after game one and just how connected he is with everyone out there. That's grown quite a bit. So as good as he was last year and as dominant of a run as he had, feels like he's even better this year. I want to ask what it's like to be around him too, just from your perspective, just, you know, covering him, talking to him, interacting with him. I know he doesn't like the press conference setting. That's like not his thing, but he likes the media and he likes interacting with guys one-on-one and he likes talking and that kind of stuff. And you've obviously had some of those interactions with him.
Yeah, I mean, he's fascinating because for the entirety of his career, it's always been a struggle to get him to come up on the podium, to step in front of the microphone. It's always, you know, oh man, is he actually going to, you know, come out and do it? But for the most part, once he gets in front of the camera, once he starts answering questions, I think one of the things that's made him so impressive over the years is he's just incredibly authentic, that as soon as you put him in front of a microphone, you ask him a question, the only thing that can come out of his mouth is what he truly feels. And that to me has kind of always been the most impressive thing about him, is he's just himself. The dad jokes are not funny. They stink. But like, he loves telling them. And the thing that makes it funny is like, he laughs harder than anyone else in the room. Like, he's all the way, he's committed. He is committed to selling those jokes that are terrible. And like, that is just, to me, like, his personality is that dude is just incredibly authentic. He says what he thinks. You know, if I think one thing that he's always appreciated about me. And, you know, him and I have been together. This is, I think, year eight. I started covering the team in his second season. Year eight together. He knows that I'm going to ask him, you know, you tossed that one out of bounds. Like, what were you thinking? Or why'd you do it? Or what? Like, whatever. Like, he's going to hear about it. And I just think he always kind of answers that question. Like, the one thing he won't answer and he will always deny when he's struggling at the rim to finish, no one has ever made him do that. He doesn't ever feel like, you know, anyone's playing good defense on him at the rim. He's just missing them. It's always going to be the same. You know, they're showing bodies, they're being physical. He'll say those same things. But, you know, outside of that, for the most part, I just find him incredibly authentic, incredibly genuine. And I think that's probably what makes him such a compelling character to so many people following him from the outside.
One of my favorite things too to look at when you're talking about a championship team is just how it comes together. And there's always really fascinating stories about how it comes together. You just need all this different stuff to hit right. With Giannis, it obviously came down to drafting him, developing him. The Jabari Parker thing going sideways, I think, opened the door for him to really become the centerpiece of the team there. But even just within the last couple of years here, you think of what John Horst has done. Brook Lopez coming in on a biannual exception. Pat Connaughton, who was pretty good in Portland, just kind of landing in their lap there. You wrote about Wes Matthews arriving, becoming a really good player, great in game one for them. Grayson Allen, really just coming there for nothing. Bobby Portis, again, showed signs in Chicago, but he comes there essentially for nothing. And they had Serge Ibaka as kind of a depth piece this year. They've just made all the right moves over the last couple of years, it feels like. And that's sort of how a championship team comes together, is you just hit all these right buttons and it all clicks and all these different little pieces work together. And Brook's like the most fascinating one of all, right? Because he changed his game, became an elite defender. You wrote about that at The Athletic. And really just became a floor spacer after becoming like this great post-up guy in Brooklyn for all those different years.
Yeah, I mean, Brook is, it's kind of crazy to think about just how foundational he is to this team. You know, like you said, he came in on the biannual. That was one of the last moves that they made in that offseason before Bud's first season. And, you know, I think everyone saw it and was like, okay, yeah, it's a solid signing. You know, obviously Brook has struggled a little bit with the Lakers, but you know, at the biannual exception, that can't be a bad move. Like, I'm sure he can give you some production, some minutes off the bench. And then all of a sudden, there's just an elite rim protector. Like, I've written about his drop coverage before. I think it's the best in the league. I think it's better than Rudy Gobert. Like,
he was a menace in game one.
He's the master of it. He knows exactly how to play the in-between, take away the pass, take away the floater, anything at the rim. You're not getting past him. He's a mountain of a human. He's 7 feet tall, 280 pounds. You know, in that game one, he had a closeout to Tatum all the way in the corner, and then Tatum drove him off of it, and he still affected Tatum's shot at the rim. Like, all of that is just kind of insane to think. Like, it's insane to think that is what Brook Lopez is now. After when the Bucks signed him, he was a defensive liability that a lot of people thought was washed up. And now he's one of the most impactful defensive players in the league, and someone that's been essential to what Giannis does. He, you know, that's your center, spacing the floor, protecting the rim. He can kind of do it all. That one is, I think, always going to kind of go down as, you know, that's like John Horst and Mike Boonholzer's. That's their crown jewel, that they took this dude from a biannual exception to the year after that biannual exception. He was, to me, the most pivotal guy that they needed to sign. They needed to figure out, okay, who do we want to bring back between, I think, Chris Middleton was a free agent, Brook Lopez was a free agent, George Hill was a free agent, Nikola Mirotic was a free agent, Malcolm Brogdon was a free agent, and they decided correctly that Brook Lopez was the guy. Like, they could have said, okay, he had a 1 year for us. Let's find somebody else to fill that same role. We did it once, right? We could do it again. Let's keep Malcolm Brogdon. He's younger. You know, he's got more potential. And they didn't do that. They said, all right.
That was controversial, yeah, at the time.
It was incredibly controversial, and they ended up making the right decision. Brook Lopez was that guy, and, you know, it's just kind of decision after decision has kind of piled up and gone that way. And you look at last year, and P.J. Tucker was their trade deadline acquisition, and, like, I was reporting on John Horst's interest in him 2 months before it happened. Like, that was their guy. They wanted PJ Tucker badly. And just like that, you know, they brought in PJ Tucker and he was the perfect fit for them.
Yeah. And that was a tough loss. We will kind of go back and forth on that one, probably depending on what this season ends up finishing as for the Bucks there. But that is something they've missed all years. The extra wing there defensively, especially now with Middleton down. Yeah, that's a tough one. And Semi Ojeleye wasn't quite the PJ Tucker. And I think a lot of Celtics fans knew that wasn't going to work. But we love Semi. Wish he was in the series on some point. But the Drew Holiday thing, we talk about Brogdon, goes to Bledsoe. Bledsoe doesn't really work. And then with that Giannis thing coming up, the next offseason, they had to make that big move, it felt like, to show, all right, we're committed. We're going to put a championship team around him, and we're going to try to keep him here. And Holiday ended up becoming that guy. They gave up a ton to get him. All those future first-round picks, they essentially went all in on him. And I think most people around the league liked Holiday, but it was like, is this going to solidify a championship team? And it did, just because he's that level of a defender that can cement a championship defense. And you wrote about it, just all the little different things that go into it. He's defended Tatum in this series, which I still can't believe is on the table, but he makes it happen. And you really have the two best defensive guards in the league probably going at it in this series between Smart and Holiday. All our viewers kind of know what makes Smart smart on that end, but what makes Holiday the defender he is and kind of the piece that put all this together in the end?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about Drew Holiday, and like you said, I spent an entire season asking people about Drew Holiday, about, you know, like, kind of what he can do and what makes him one of the best defenders in the league. Like, I think it starts with his physical skills. I think if you look at his legs, they are just tree trunks. You can't move that dude. It doesn't matter who's trying to post him up. It's just not, I mean, it could work, but it's going to take you a long time to get to your spot. You're not going to be able to do it easily. And in the meantime, he's probably going to try to strip you, and he'll probably be successful because he's that good. So you start there, then you add on top of it insane instincts. Then you add on it the fact that he grew up in the NBA under Andre Iguodala. Like, Iguodala taught him a bunch of stuff in Philadelphia. So you're just adding all of these levels to it.
That's right.
Where all of a sudden you have the strongest, quickest dude that has these very long arms, that has incredible instincts, that has been taught all of the things, the nature, the nurture, this physical talent and skills and attributes. And you all of a sudden just have this dude that is an unbelievable defender. He can go up and down the ladder. He has unbelievable instincts. He's got great hands. Like, there's just so many things that he does well that all of a sudden you get to a spot where he can just cover anyone. And you know, during the regular season, they put him on Tatum a lot. And I was curious if they were going to try to do that again in this series, if it'd be Wesley Matthews. And we've seen a mix of both, but yeah, I mean, the Bucks have a lot of confidence that he can cover anyone on that Celtics roster. And it's just kind of, it speaks to how versatile and unbelievable he is as a defender, that that's not crazy. Like, yeah, he can. He can do that.
Before we get you out of here, I do want to get your impression of the Celtics. They've had an insane turnaround this year. Blew through Brooklyn in the first round, and then essentially came into the series as favorites. They got the home court from the way the end of the regular season shook out, and after two games, shown to be legitimate on that defensive side of the floor. It's an amazing defensive system that they run when Robert Williams is going at his full level, and they even have the depth behind him to maintain it, as we've seen in this series, because Rob really hasn't been a big factor on that end. And of course, you got Jaylen Brown doing what he did to start game two alongside Tatum. They're the prolific duo. Does this team have a championship in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are if the Bucks are the best team in the East, the Celtics are the second best team in the East. And if the Bucks aren't the best team in the East, then to me, I think it's the Celtics. Like, I just, the way that they defend, the way that they can switch, you know, the physical defenders that they have, the intellectual minds of all those defenders as well. Like, I just think when you're talking about playoff defense, you want to be able to switch. You want to be able to have rim protection. You know, you want to be able to have guys on the perimeter that can defend. The Celtics have all of that. I think to me coming into this series and still in this series, I do have some question about their half court offense. I thought, you know, it was going to be interesting to see in this series what happened when they stopped getting 20 free points in transition from the Nets doing whatever the Nets do.
I mean, he may even said it. He threw some shade at them. It was like game one. I think we had to get used to kind of seeing a team that was defensive minded again.
Yeah, no. And that's like exactly what it was, where it's just like, all right, 20 free points because nobody on the Nets decided to get back in transition. So to me, like, that's where the question lies is, you know, how real was everything that Jason Tatum has done? Cause he's made these massive steps forward, at least in my mind, as a playmaker this year. And it's okay, that is true. He's been much better, but you know, when playoff defenses get tough, like when the Milwaukee Bucks come to town, can he still do all of those things? Can he still create in that same way? Can he be the basis of the offense? And I think thus far in this series, we've seen that the Bucks have essentially tried to do everything they can to take away his ability to score. And he's made the passes, he's made the plays. And that to me really speaks to just how much he's grown, because I think in the past you could try to bait Jason Tatum into taking long jumpers. You could bait him into trying to play isolation basketball. And that hasn't worked really in this series. The Bucks have tried to take him away as a scorer, and he's made the right pass. He's made the right play. And to me, that's going to be this series is, you know, that half court offense. I know it was spectacular in the final 3 months of the season. But to me, if there is a question about the Celtics, it's that. But even that, it might not matter. The defense just might be good enough, right? Like, I watched the Bucks put together one of the best defensive postseasons in modern history, let's say the last 20 years, last year, and they didn't score that well. It didn't matter that they didn't score that well because they had the best defense. If the Celtics have the best defense, they might just be able to win this thing with that alone and just being fine on offense. So I do think this is a team that is capable of winning a championship and doing so this year, but we'll see, because I think this series is going to be a good one.
It's going to be a battle, and you talked about the back and forth at the beginning. I think that's what we're in for all the way through seven games. The defense point's key. That's going to travel to Milwaukee, even if all these role player performances don't, even if all the shooting that they got in game two top to bottom doesn't. They're going to stay in the game just by stringing stops together, and their ability to do that against Durant now, as we've seen Giannis shut down Jokic during the year, and really that was the formula that's driven them to 33 wins over the last 41 here. So it's consistent. It gives them a floor every night. Even if they're not going to win the game, they're going to be in it because of that defense. And again, the clash of styles in this series, really exciting. Make sure you continue to follow Eric on the Bucks side as we progress into game three here. Games every other night once again at theathletic.com. You can sign up and subscribe there today. It's well worth it for the storytelling you get. Appreciate your time today, Eric. And of course, check out our Celtics post-game show here. After game three, we'll be in Milwaukee. Josue, Sherrod, and I for that series. And of course, show some love to our sponsor, HelloFresh, hellofresh.com/playoff16, playoff16, 16 free meals, 3 free gifts. Eric, appreciate you. We will see you in Milwaukee, and enjoy the rest of the series and your coverage out there.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.